I mean, why do people climb Mount Everest? To me, ferrying airplanes across the ocean is very similar in a lot of ways, maybe not from the physical aspect of it, but from the mental and, you know, what fulfills somebody, it's probably on that same level.
Hey everyone, it's Ryan here with Cardinal Aviation. Welcome to episode number 35 of the Audio Briefings. I'm super excited to have you guys here today. Thank you for joining us. And we are going to get to do an awesome interview with Sarah Rovner. And going along with the theme of all of our sessions here, it's all about continued learning, about transforming the way you fly, learning from one another, and from the experiences that we have had, because tribal knowledge is so key in aviation. And we can learn from others' decision-making, others' experiences to help make ourselves better every time we take to the skies. And that's what today's interview with Sarah is going to be all about, kind of getting into her head and finding out what her considerations are when she takes an airplane, be it across the continent or across the Atlantic Ocean. And yes, we are talking piston single airplanes. Before we get to that interview, though, I just wanted to let you guys know we do these podcasts because we love doing it. We love sharing information. We love talking aviation. And we're trying to do a nice mix of some interviews and some kind of technical lecture-y stuff. If you feel that you're getting some value out of this, I mean, really all we ask is that we get some feedback from you. You can hit us up on Instagram at Cardinal Aviation or by email info@cardinalaviation.ca. But if you feel so inclined, you can go to our website, cardinalaviation.ca/podcast. And on there, there's two buttons. You can pick up some Cardinal Aviation gear. We got some awesome hoodies, t-shirts, and hats. Or if you just want to make a contribution to the show to help us keep putting out this content to help your flying, we would be very appreciative. If nothing else, we just like conversing with you. Go ahead, send us an email, and we're happy to chat. All right, without any further delay, here's my interview with Sarah Rovner. Okay, so I've got Sarah Rovner here, and Sarah is the, I don't even know what your title is. What is it? Chief pilot, owner, CEO, what is it?
I'm the chief pilot and owner of Full Throttle Aviation.
When it comes to badass pilots, we say it, but she is it, and that's why I wanted to talk to her. There's one thing I want to just like get out of the way right away. I don't know, I just kind of call it as it is, and I want to make sure that we're on the right side of everything. For whatever reason, when I was thinking about the intro, I was thinking badass lady pilot, but I don't like strapping the word lady in front of pilot because I feel like it's, I don't know if it's productive, if it's counterproductive. I mean, we're all pilots at the end, but what are your feelings on that? I just want to get that out of the way.
Well, I think that the airplane doesn't know the difference and whether or not the pilot's going to be a male or a female. So it doesn't really bother me to be called, you know, a lady pilot because I am a lady pilot. But in the end, it's all about training and skill and it has nothing to do with gender. So
perfect. Okay. So badass pilot. Let's just go with that. Okay. So I got to know Sarah through the kind of ferry world and I had a job that needed to be done, an airplane going from Canada to the States. So I reached out to Sarah and her team was awesome. They got it done. We kind of kept in touch, but I gotta admit, with everything that you've done and everything that you do, I was super intimidated when I talked to you on the phone the first time. Do you hear that a lot?
I actually do hear that quite a bit. So I'm trying to be a little bit more soft when I talk to people at times.
I get the feedback sometimes that I'm intimidating, but I was just like, I do not want to get on the wrong side of Sarah after like our first phone call it was awesome. Okay. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Like what's, maybe not the whole story from first flight to now, but who's Sarah?
So I started my aviation career. It's actually kind of started on accident. So when I was 18, I went into the military, got out, started flying as a hobby. I took my first discovery flight when I was trying to charter a plane, which was another kind of crazy story. I called the local flight school and says, hey, can you give me a ride from Houston to Austin? They said, well, we can't charter a plane for you, but if you want to come take lessons, we can send an instructor with you. And so I ended up on this discovery flight. I absolutely fell in love with aviation. After I got out of the military, I started working as a network engineer, specifically in oil and gas, which financed all of my flight training. So I got my private and then, you know, realized I really loved it, got my instrument, got my commercial, got my CFI, and then the opportunity came to make the transition from being a network engineer to a full-time pilot. And at that time, I just, you know, took a leap of faith, took a $100,000 pay cut, went to the regionals, and then worked my way up from there. I got involved in ferry flying and then eventually got a job with the major airlines in the United States. So that was kind of my path in a nutshell. I kind of took a little bit different path, but I knew one thing was for sure from the very first time I set foot in an airplane, and then that was what I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
And it seems like you definitely do that day in, day out based on your online presence and the experience that you've amassed in a relatively, I guess, short time. I mean, you've busted your ass for it. So like, I want to kind of focus in on the ferry flying. How did you get into how did that happen? Like, how did that opportunity present itself? How did it kind of grow on itself?
I have a very interesting story for that too. I get a lot of questions from people all over the world. They say, well, how do I get into ferry flying? What do I need to do? And the crazy thing is that was never something that I sought out. It kind of just happened. My very first ferry flight was a Citabria going from Houston to Las Vegas. I kind of had developed a reputation within the area for being experienced in old vintage tailwheel airplanes. And my very first customer was moving out to Vegas, needed the airplane moved, and that was my very first ferry flight. My second ferry flight was a student that I had who had purchased an aircraft, and we went out to Arizona and picked it up. And my very third ferry flight was all the way from Canada down to Belize. And then when I first was asked about it, I didn't even know where the country of Belize was. I kept calling it Brazil. And then I eventually learned that it was Belize. It shared a border with Mexico and Guatemala. And that was my very third ferry flight. And actually, I initially declined the flight. I said, okay, I'll go to Canada, pick up the airplane and move it to Houston. And I was going to subcontract the other half of the ferry flight out to somebody else who had more experience south of the border. And the other pilot went off the runway and ground looped the airplane. luckily, there was no damage to the aircraft. But then I was asked to continue the ferry flight since it was my name who had agreed to do it. And so I jumped in this Cessna ag truck, Cessna 188 ag truck, and flew it all the way down through Mexico to Belize. And that was the start of my international ferry flying career. So I kind of had a little bit different way of getting into it than most people. It kind of just fell into my lap, and I found that it was something that I loved doing.
Which you kind of lead me into two other areas that I'd kind of written down here. And you said you didn't set out to do ferry flying, but I think we all see it if you're on any sort of like online flying forum or Facebook group or whatever. There's people that get their commercial license and have a pulse and be like, I'm a ferry pilot and I'll move your airplane and I'll do it for free, or I will even pay you for the time because I'm getting the experience. And I mean, that just, I don't know. I think a little bit of us were all there at one point, like maybe for a day or two, like thinking like, oh, I can go do anything. What do you think about that? That people think I can just go do this. Do you think they should just go do this, or what kind of preparation do you think they should have or consider before they take stuff like this on?
Well, it's an interesting point you bring up because, you know, I always called it undercutting, but then I take myself back in time and I remember a time where you had to pay somebody to build flight time. Yep. It's only been this recent, I'd probably say past maybe 5 or 10 years, that you've been able to get jobs at 250 hours and get to the airlines at 100 at 1500. You know, ATP, for example, which is a big, you know, company that builds pilots in a fairly quick amount of time. They had a syllabus that would give the pilots like a couple hundred hours of multi, because that's what you used to have, or that's what you would need to get hired on at the airlines. And so for the longest time, there was even this guy at one of my airports who you'd have to pay to sit in his right seat in a King Air. So there was a time where pilots were not in as high demand as they are now, and the salaries were a lot less. And I understand that, you know, when you're a new pilot, you're trying to get into it. That being said, it depends on what type of ferry flying you do. So if you're just moving, you know, like you're in Canada, right? If you're moving an airplane from, let's say, Calgary to Edmonton, well, that's not a very complicated flight. It's probably something that anybody can do. If you've got experience in that type of aircraft, it becomes just a routine flight. But when you start getting into things like what I do, where you're taking airplanes across the ocean, or you're having to deal with customs and paperwork in all these different countries, then that becomes a whole different ballgame. So as far as trying to get started with it, if it's a fairly routine flight, it's an aircraft you're familiar with and a route that's fairly simple, then that probably is something that a new pilot can jump into. But if your goal for ferry flying, and what I consider to be ferry flying, is, you know, taking the seats out and putting tanks in them,
that's what I was going to ask you is what's your definition?
Yeah, that kind of flying is going to require a lot more preparation and training and experience than just ferrying something domestically.
When did you do your first Atlantic crossing, and what airplane was it in?
So I had been unsuccessful for years of trying to get my first Atlantic crossing. I mean, I tried everything. And a lot of people who do it had to get into it somehow, right? I mean, you can't get insurance until you've already done it, and you can't do it until you've already done it. And so it's this never-ending cycle. But I was trying unsuccessfully for years to get in it. My two bucket list items were I wanted to fly a turbine ag plane, and I wanted to take a plane across the North Atlantic. And I quoted jobs. I sat there, you know, planning them. I tried it so many times, and at the last minute it would fall through because insurance wouldn't cover me because I didn't have the experience. And I finally got my first break. There was a guy who was flying a King Air C-90 from the USA over to France. And I offered to do all the handling and the paperwork for him and also sit in the right seat as a co-pilot. And he had already crossed once before so he could get the insurance. And he took me up on the offer because I was offering, you know, I mean, for example, Universal would probably charge $700 per leg, and that's what I was charging per day. So, you know, it was really cost beneficial for him, and I was able to sit in the right seat, do all the handling, all the paperwork, work the radios, and I learned a lot about it. I got, you know, the process down, and that's what I started doing. I started advertising my services as a multi-engine instructor and a CFI, flying alongside owners on the crossings, and they would be responsible for the insurance. And so I sat right seat for probably 4 or 5 crossings with owners before I started doing them solo and training other pilots.
Exactly. It's like you're reading my mind. I was going to ask you how many dual ones you did before you did one on your own there. So, I mean, as a ferry pilot, I get asked this a lot as well. Like, how do you just jump into another airplane? Like, don't you go get checked out? What's your process when you're presented with an airplane that maybe you haven't flown before? Like, what are your considerations? What do you go through mentally as you prepare to fly a new type?
That's a really good question. And it really just depends on the aircraft. So for example, ag planes, most of them are one seat airplanes. You can't get a checkout. You have to kind of go over it with somebody, and then you've got to go and just jump in the plane and fly it at some point. For different types of aircraft, we normally try to match our pilots with airplanes that they're similar. So for example, like a Wagabond versus a Vagabond, or a Cristavia MK1 as compared to a Champ. They're all very similar to each other. So we try to start pilots off in those new aircraft. We do a lot of experimentals. We do a lot of home builds, a lot of just oddball airplanes. So usually what that involves is reading the POH. I put together an index card with all the V speeds, limitations, everything like that. And then if it's something that's just really strange, then I start talking to people who've flown it before. And then from there, I kind of build on that. I set very strict personal limitations. So if I'm flying a new tailwheel airplane for the first time, I avoid, you know, runways with, you know, more than a 5-knot crosswind. I don't land on, you know, 2,500 foot by 50 foot strips when I first start out. And then I kind of just build up into that experience level. And if it's something that's really strange or really challenging, then I will oftentimes ask for the owner to fly with me for a few landings before I go solo.
So there's, you know, you got to kind of check your ego at the door there a little bit and not be like, I can do anything. Don't worry about it. It's like you sent me the list of questions that I wrote before I called you, because I was going to ask you about personal minimums. And the whole point of, I mean, the Audio Briefings podcast is all about kind of personal development and learning in aviation and proficiency and professionalism and just constantly improving. And one thing we always talk about is personal minimums and establishing them and writing them down, but also finding a way to expand them kind of over time, stretch them a little bit in a controlled manner. So again, like, what are Sarah's personal minimums? How do you approach that conversation? I mean, you just talked about new tailwheel airplanes, but even when you're considering a crossing or a transcon, like, what are your like absolute thou shalt nots?
I don't like to, there's a few things I don't like to do. I've got kind of rules. It really just depends on the capabilities of the aircraft. You know, what I'm willing to fly at in, you know, a King Air that has known icing protection is going to be very, very different than what I fly at, for example, in that Turbo Saratoga that I just took across. So it really just depends on the aircraft, its capabilities. One thing I will not do, and this is a big thing, is I will not operate contrary to the limitations of the POH. Like, for example, I wanted to take the Turbo Saratoga across, but the POH charts didn't go up to 25,000 feet, so I had to pick a route that would allow me to do it. I know people are like, oh, you'll get it up there, no problem, but I don't believe in that. I don't operate contrary to the limitations of the POH. In terms of weather, I don't like filing alternates I don't have the fuel to get to, which a lot of ferry pilots do. I don't, you know, I make sure that all of the TAFs are legal for where I'm going. If the airplane is not equipped with icing protection, then I avoid icing conditions. And there's a lot of things that go into that. But there's no one size fits all for weather. The weather that I'm willing to fly at in the Rocky Mountains is going to be very different than the weather that I'm willing to fly at, let's say, you know, in a flat area like Alabama. So, you know, even in the Rocky Mountains, the 5,000 foot ceilings could be mountain obscuration and the passes could still be closed. So it really just depends on the region, and having that experience and having been there before and knowing the terrain really comes into play.
Yeah, I think one of my personal ones is with single engine airplanes, even if it's de-icing or anti-icing, whatever equipped, like the first flight, I will not fly like at night or IMC. Like I want to get at least one flight in it, good IMC or sorry, good VMC to make sure everything works. I can trust it before I start playing that game, at least with singles. But I don't know. Is that something you consider when you're flying, or are you just like, screw it, I'm going for it?
Oh no, I never go over water the first leg. I always, you know, like for example, in this Lancer, I've already flown at 2000 miles and I've already done the runs, and, you know, I sit there with a little notebook and I log, you know, the power settings I used on climb, the fuel flow, when I leveled off. And I'm very, very precise when it comes down to performance. I don't just trust what's in the POH.
Trend sheets are huge. Trend sheets are huge because you can see, especially like changes developing over the hours, and kind of it's a, hopefully notice something before it becomes a big issue. So if you had a choice of, how many crossings have you done now?
I would 50. Probably have to look it up. It's over 50 total, between large airplanes and small airplanes.
Is it getting old, or no, that's your thing. That's your jam.
I definitely want to do more twins and less single engine airplanes for sure. I always make the joke, whenever I land in Scotland, you know, Drew comes out to the airplane and says, oh, they keep getting smaller. It's like, I thought you said you were quitting. And I tell him that every time. I said, I'm done. Then I keep going back to it. So
speaking of smaller, you did a Saratoga, 3 weeks ago? So a single Saratoga to, was Romania or Germany or
no, something. It's to Germany. Yes.
Germany. And then you had one on the books. I don't know if it's a go or not, but you were going to do a Lancer.
I'm leaving tomorrow for that one.
For those that don't know what a Lancer is, you want to kind of explain the challenge of this one as it is unique to that airplane?
Well, Lancer is a single engine, 2-seat home built airplane. This one was actually built really well. It's my first time taking an experimental aircraft across the ocean, but this one's actually in really good shape. It's been meticulously maintained. I've, you know, personally inspected everything. And by the time I go over my first water leg, I'll have over 3,000 miles on the aircraft. So it's actually in really good shape. And believe it or not, it's a very capable aircraft. Probably the worst range aircraft that I ever flew across was a brand new 206. That one on the books has 703 nautical miles of range. I mean, you can't make any of the water legs without stopping twice in Greenland, twice in Iceland. That's eastbound. You know, that one just had horrible range, but the Lancer itself actually has really good range. And I compared, you know, what the book says to the performance, and the performance exceeds what's in the book. So
can you tank the last Lancer? Are you tanking?
No, we don't need to. With 66 gallons, it has about 1,100 miles of range. I just have to watch the winds.
And I mean, that's a tight little area in the cockpit. It's 2-seat, but it's small. So, I mean, it's like choosing between a raft and your lunch bag. What's it going to be?
Believe it or not, the Lancer Legacy has a decent, useful load. It really does, better than people think. And I actually found it to be quite comfortable. I actually bought a different survival suit because I wasn't quite sure my Mustang suit would fit, but I actually fit just fine with the Mustang suit in the airplane. It's really not as bad as people think. It's actually quite comfortable. And there's plenty of room right behind the 2 seats for my raft and my duffel bag and my flight bag and my suitcase. So it actually has pretty decent useful load.
And I mean, you're sitting out there I've crossed over flying jets several times, and then in a single only once westbound. And so that was kind of my intro. And I was flying with somebody who's done like 400 crossings. And I mean, when it was in a single engine turboprop, so it's not a piston, so it's not as crazy, but it was in December. And the entire crossing was at night. So we left Scotland, it got dark, got to Iceland, spent the night. It was still dark when we took off there, and then to Iqaluit, it was still dark when we landed there, got gas. And then the sun came up just as we were getting to Rankin. So the whole thing was in the dark, and it almost, I don't know if that made it better just because I couldn't see water and I couldn't see ice. So it's like, it wasn't there. I could tune it out. Wait, what's going through your mind when you're halfway between Iceland and Europe? Cause you know, the Faroe Islands don't exist. So what's going through your mind? Like, does the engine start making funny sounds? Like, what is that like to be on your own, kind of completely isolated?
Well, the good news is that it's usually cloudy over the ocean. So there's only been a few, I mean, out of all of my crossings, maybe a few hours that you actually see the water. So I guess that's kind of a good thing. Wintertime, it's more challenging. In the summer, you can probably survive if you're prepared and, you know, the right time and everything like that. I mean, I went through the dunking course up in Manitoba. Winnipeg, yep. And did the dunking course. You know, I've done survival training. I have all the gear. I have the right gear. And so the way I take an approach is like, we're pilots, right? I mean, let's say you're flying a multi-engine aircraft. If you lose one engine, there's a procedure for that. And if you lose two engines, there's a procedure for that. And so the way I see it is that you have your primary system, you know, which is everything's functioning normally. And then you have your backup system, which is things aren't functioning normally, which is your raft and your suit. And then you have your tertiary backup system, where if you somehow end up in the water and you don't get your raft out, well, now you at least have the suit. So that's the way I look at things, is that I look at it as, with preparation and careful planning, it mitigates the risk to an acceptable level. And I don't touch the power. I set the power and I don't touch it till I'm within gliding distance of land.
Yeah, like, I'm not touching that mixture. Like, it's done, it's happy. Don't freaking touch it. That's awesome. Cool. I mean, this is super interesting. I know people are going to find it really interesting, because it's kind of this mythical, like, unknown that we only read books about. Are you going to write a book one day?
Eventually, maybe. When the statute of limitations has passed, of course.
Yeah. What? So if you had a choice right now, let's say somebody gave you a bonanza and said, I need you to move this. And it was, you can either move it money aside, like forget the pay, across the ocean or transcon from like the East Coast to the West Coast, which would you choose? Like, you'd either go
transcon.
Transcon, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not, you're not doing it for the fun.
Spectacular, yeah. Though. I mean, I've seen things that most people would never see in their entire lifetime. I mean, the scenery is spectacular, that feeling of isolation and beauty, and you're on the edge of your mental and physical performance. I really enjoy that. It's really interesting. I read an article about a woman who, you know, hiked down to the South Pole in Antarctica, and she wrote an article about it. She said, well, these are the 7 reasons that I did it. And I said, well, you know what? These are very similar to the reasons that I do that. I mean, why do people climb Mount Everest? To me, ferrying airplanes across the ocean is very similar in a lot of ways, maybe not from the physical aspect of it, but from the mental and, you know, what fulfills somebody, it's probably on that same level.
I mean, you get that sense of accomplishment when the mission's done. Like, you...
It's like winning the lottery every time when you land in mainland Europe.
So, and I mean, you're going to do a kind of vlog type series on what goes into a crossing. And I think you're going to put that on your Facebook there, but you said something really interesting when you were doing a live, the other day or a couple of weeks ago, where when it comes, I don't want to go into this like the day before you leave on a trip, but you know, I mean, you're a pro and a veteran at this. You said something about, acceptance of risk. And when you go on these trips, like, there's something that you just have to accept, and it's just, it is what it is, and you're prepared for whatever it may be. Do you want to touch on that?
You have to be. But it's like that with every flight, isn't it?
It is.
You know,
the airplane doesn't know if it's over water. Like, the airplane doesn't know it's over water, just like the airplane doesn't know if it's a man or a woman that's flying it. No different, right?
Of course. No, I mean, that could happen to you. I mean, you could go out in your airplane and the same thing could happen. We take risk every time we get into an aircraft. You know, you have to, and I mean, obviously the perceived risk is going to be less if you're flying over land, because, you know, even with a land forced off airport landing, you don't have to rely on survival. And well, so depending on where you are, you fly up in Northern Canada in the winter, it's really the same thing. Yeah. But you have to accept the risk when you do these kind of things. But the way I approach it is from a risk mitigation standpoint. I'm very particular about which airplanes I take. You know, I won't take engines that are past TBO. I don't take airplanes that have had prop strikes. If the value of the airplane is 50% lower than what I've seen everything else go for, I start, you know, getting weird feelings about it. So I'm very particular.
How often do you like lay eyes and hands on an airplane? Like, you show up and you're just like, no, not, this isn't happening.
I've turned quite a few down. Very, very particular.
That's good. I mean, the first time doing that must have been pretty hard. And then you're like, you know what? Sometimes you just got to say no, and you get like that first no out of the way, and then it becomes that much easier.
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, you got to think about safety, right? I mean, it's sometimes it's really hard to turn down a job, and it's really, you know, especially when you have money on the line or something like that. But sometimes you just have to say no, whether that's a weather call or not flying a particular airplane. I've said no so many times. It's just part of the job.
What's the longest weather delay you've ever had? Like in
2 weeks.
2 weeks in one spot?
Mm-hmm.
Where was that?
I ended up leaving and coming back, but yes.
Where was that?
In Iceland, normally aspirated airplane going overseas in February, which is really bad weather.
So how many days did you stay put before you're like, screw this, I'm going home, I'll be back?
4 days before I left and then came back, you know, another about a week and a half later. So.
And do you feel like you're, I mean, you know, we didn't talk about this yet, but you also, I think you're off your day job right now, but you, up until COVID there, were flying the 757-767. Did you find that your ferry flying made you a better airline pilot, or the other way around, or are they just two totally different worlds?
I would say that they're two totally different worlds, but a lot of the experiences you have as a ferry pilot help prepare you for that airline flying. You know, for example, I was, you know, sitting there because I did a lot of flying across the ocean, and I would be talking to them about all these airports in Greenland, and a lot of these captains and even other FOs had never even heard of these places. And I'm like, well, the weather normally does this, and if the winds are out of this direction, this normally happens. And they just are completely mind blown. And then one captain I flew with had downloaded a chart for one of those emergency airports in Greenland. I think it was Nisarsuaq, which we're not really allowed to go there. Even in emergencies, we don't even have charts for it. He was like, well, if I just needed a strip of pavement to put it on, I'm going to go here. And I was like, well, let me tell you about this approach and these fjords. And, you know, I mean, I think that if a really serious emergency were to happen, that ferry flying skill set would likely make a difference. But in daily operations, I mean, being a ferry pilot doesn't prepare you for dealing with unruly passengers. So,
Nisarsuaq is that they've got some pretty weird operating hours, right? And like, you got to really watch your times when you go in there.
If you don't want to pay fees, but if you file it as an alternate, or if you head there, there will be somebody there for you. They're just going to make you pay thousands of dollars to leave. So,
yeah, I heard that's pretty crazy there. Okay, cool. I want to basically ask you three more, one more question about this stuff and then kind of into non-ferry stuff. So what, one thing that scares you, what scares Sarah?
Poor maintenance, probably.
Yeah.
Poor maintenance and weather. I'm a chicken when it comes down to weather. I don't like chancing weather. I've definitely sat on the ground for an extra day in Iceland while my peers went. So I like to have good weather.
And then talking about peers, I mean, it's obviously a competitive business. Everyone's kind of bidding the same jobs. People usually go out looking for the cheapest rate and, you know, they'll go with who they trust. But even your competitors, like, what is it like? Is there, do you have cooperative relationships with them? Do you guys help each other out? Or when you're out there, is it kind of like every person for themselves, like you're on your own? How does that work?
For most of my competitors, I would say I have a good cooperative relationship with them. Sometimes there's jobs that they can't do that I'll do and vice versa. So we do sometimes do referrals. I've also done group crossings with competitors. So we look after each other. Obviously, there's a business aspect to that, but we look after each other because in the end, we're all pilots, you know, and so we're all in this together and we help each other out.
We can learn a lot about, you know, we take some stuff away from flying and maybe apply it to non-flying life too, and the world would be a better place. So tell me about Stanley.
So Stanley is my Cessna 170. but the name comes from one of my students. There was a young man who I taught how to fly. He bought a Cessna 170 and I taught him how to fly it in Houston, and we became pretty close. He was almost like a brother to me. And we even flew the plane up to Oshkosh together. We have crazy stories from sticking a flashlight out the window, landing at Chicago Midway late at night, sleeping in the FBO. And just, it was a great experience. And unfortunately, Stanley was a passenger in an aircraft that crashed up in Alaska and he passed away. And so my original goal was to purchase his 170, but it kind of ended up deteriorating and got locked up in the estate. And so I haven't had a chance to do that. So I purchased this 170 and I named it Stanley and hope to fly it around in his memory and camp under the wing at Oshkosh, just like we did together.
And you're also using that airplane for your tailwheel school, right?
That's correct.
So do you want to, it's kind of the last thing I was just going to ask if you wanted to talk about the flight training program that you offer and where it is and what you kind of specialize in.
So the program that I have is kind of is Delaware Valley Tail Directors, and we're located at the Northeast Philadelphia Airport, Philadelphia. And what we offer is kind of an intense 3-day tailwheel course where somebody could come in from out of state or even, you know, locally, and we would focus for 3 days, usually a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and try to get their tailwheel endorsement knocked out. I've been very successful with that, and we've done scholarships for people, and we have both a Cessna 170 and a Super Cub. So the idea is, you know, to get the tailwheel training done and also offer them an introduction to bush type flying with the Super Cub. So come out for 3 days, knock out the tailwheel endorsement, and walk away with the experience of a lifetime.
Awesome. And what airplane would you start them in, the 170 or the Super Cub?
Definitely in the 170, start them out. The 170 is I consider to be much more forgiving than the Super Cub, and it will definitely teach them more rudder discipline. The Super Cub has this amazing performance. It'll take off and land in nothing. But the 170, you got to work at it a little bit more. So I feel like the 170 will train them to be even more precise tailwheel pilots, and then we move into the Super Cub for more of the fun portion of it.
I mean, you've flown God knows how many types, but if there's like one airplane that you've never flown that you're like, Sarah wants to get her hands on that because it's your bucket list airplane. What is it? Anything?
PC-6 Pilatus Porter. The tailwheel turbine Pilatus Porter is on my bucket list.
Why the Porter?
I've always admired its short field performance, and I've always admired its size. And so for me, it's like, you know, it's like a turbine bush plane for me. And so I think that would be a lot of fun.
And then of everything that you have flown, if you had to pick one to fly every single day, which one would it be?
Super Cub.
That's what they all say. Awesome. Cool, Sarah. Well, is there anything that I missed or that you want to add?
No, I'd like to thank you once again for having me. And I hope that everything that I discussed is insightful for people who are looking to get into ferry flying. And I will say that, you know, I'm really big into mentoring. So if anybody out there has questions or wants to know how to get into it, I'm more than glad to help and be a mentor. Also, I'm hoping that next year we'll be doing more scholarships again with Full Throttle Aviation, as well as continuing our internship program so that people can get introduced to ferry flying in a safe environment.
That's all. I think like mentorship is so important. I think we all kind of have, you know, a couple, lack of better terms, like pet projects, like people that we believe in that have shown us that potential that we want to pour our time and experience into to help foster that. So I think that's so cool that you do that. If you want to check out Full Throttle Aviation, you can go to the Cardinal website at the bottom under companies that we're proud to be partnered with. Their logo and link is there. So you can click there and check out Sarah's website. I want to wish, I mean, today's July 5th, so I'll wish you a belated happy 4th. Yeah, have a really safe journey with the Lance Air starting tomorrow. I can't wait to follow it on wherever you're going to share it, your Facebook, or if somebody wants to kind of follow what you're doing or where you are, what's the best way for them to do that? Or do you, when you're on a trip, kind of just focus on the trip? Like what's your bag there?
I usually have to focus on the trip. As much as I would like to say that crossings are fun, they're usually filled with lots of flying, short nights, and, you know, so I don't always get to post until I've landed somewhere like Iceland. So a good way to follow me is I actually have a link to my live tracker at any time on my website, so you can kind of see my location, and then I generally post updates to Facebook.
You know what? I think I might try and push this one out tonight just so that anybody that listens can maybe follow you over the next couple of days. And I'll grab that tracker link and I'll put it in the show notes on our website. So awesome, Sarah. It's so great to talk to you. It's the first time we're seeing each other face to face. We've done lots of emailing. I feel less intimidated now, so thank you for that. Yeah, fly safe, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much once again. You fly safe as well.
There you have it. There's our interview with Sarah Rovner. I've got another interview coming up, which I'm super excited about, and that is another Sarah Nisler. And Sarah is another badass pilot, and she is the digital marketing manager for EAA, the Experimental Aircraft Association. And if you know anything about EAA, their flagship event, Oshkosh and Sun and Fun, she's in charge of all the social media, all the online content for those two events, and that is no small job, especially in a online world such as we are in now. And I mean, as things have fallen with COVID and Oshkosh has been canceled, they have made a major pivot, and they're doing Spirit of Aviation Week, and Sarah's going to be with us to talk about her flying journey, how she has really been the force behind moving Oshkosh 2020 online. So we're going to talk about that, and hopefully we'll have that out in a couple days. In the meantime, if you want to see any show notes from this episode, a link to Sarah's tracker, go to www.cardinalaviation.ca/podcast. And when you're there, there's a button. You can check out the Cardinal Aviation gear. You can make a little contribution to the show if you'd like. And if you go through the menus on top, you can check out all about the Cardinal Aviation coaches, the services that we provide to our clients. And we're happy to answer any of your questions at any time. So make sure you subscribe to this, leave a review in Apple Podcasts. And until next time, fly safely, never stop learning.